Guitar Radio Show.
Over the years, we've had episodes that didn't work out very well. Corrupt files, digital mishaps, whatever. So those episodes didn't get aired. So this year, during the pandemic, I went ahead and had those files sent off to somebody who could help me uncorrupt them. Some of them were successful. So we're going to be airing, finally, these lost episodes. And these are going to be episodes of some artists that I'd really like you to hear. So what we've done, though, is slightly different, is obviously when they were here, to usually promote something. But what we've done is gone ahead and put in their latest music to help them promote that. And at the very end, some of their older music that they were actually here for originally. So enjoy the lost episodes.
Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should. Ladies and gentlemen, we have with us a Renaissance person, someone that does it all. And in the world of DIY, such as it is, more and more people are doing that, but not to this level, I don't think. This is pretty prolific. We have with us an author, columnist, kick-ass guitar player and singer, blues aficionado, someone who's a columnist for the Huffington Post, Village Voice, Rolling Stone, Guitar World, Vintage Guitar, and if all things don't get out, Yoga Journal as well. She is the ASCAP award-winning author of the book The Language of the Blues. She has an album out with her band Davey. It is called Get Free, and a new single that just arrived called Butterfly, which is to become part of an EP later on. We have Deborah Davey. How are you, Deborah?
Hey, Mark. I'm good. Glad to be here.
How was that?
That was fabulous. I almost don't recognize myself.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got to tell you, I am so impressed. When Scott Thomas told me about you, I was like, all right, because he's always turning me on to somebody. And
Scott
is great. And he turned me on to you, and I just started digging and digging. And the more I drilled down, I was like, whoa, this person does it all. When do you sleep?
Oh, I get enough sleep. You know, I just don't always clean as much as I should. You know, or sometimes I'm scrambling to make a meal at the last minute, and I'm thinking, scrambled eggs again, you know.
Well, but, it's
great. I love being a musician and a writer because they really balance each other, because writing is so darn solitary, and music performing is so incredibly not solitary and social. So they really kind of help me out.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's cool. I mean, you know, it's funny. And I watched a lot of your live performances on YouTube and stuff. And you're in that way also, you leave it all out on the stage too. It's pretty.
Yeah, it's good therapy.
Yeah, it is. It is a catharsis. Yeah.
It's cathartic for sure.
Yeah.
I get pretty cranky if I haven't gotten a chance to really rock out hard.
Yeah.
Any period of time.
I'm with you.
It's become a necessity.
I'm with you. It got to a point back in the days when I was a touring musician, there was a point where we started carrying around oxygen. because I would get myself in such a frenzy by the end of the show that usually I'd collapse and pass out.
And that's awesome. They'd have to administer oxygen to you?
Yeah, and I would wake up either on the bus or in a dressing room, and I'd be like, how'd it go?
Oh, man. I have to look up some of them. Do you have any of those
performances? I'll send you some stuff. Yeah.
You have to send me something.
Yeah, it's pretty scary.
Even James Brown didn't take it that far.
No, but there was one guy. A Meatloaf did.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but that was because of his weight, I think, more than it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
But folks, go to DeborahDavey.com. Let me spell that for you. The last name Davey is actually spelled D-E-V-I. So don't be misled by the pronunciation. So you can get on there, DeborahDavey.com. When did it start for you? Why did you pick up the guitar in the first place?
Well, I actually wanted to start playing electric guitar when I was 15. But when I pushed my mom with that idea, she was somewhat mortified. She told me that was an unladylike idea. So I played, God bless my mom, but I played acoustic guitar a little bit. And then when I was a senior in college, I saw Bonnie Raitt. She came through town. I was at Madison, Wisconsin. And she had this gorgeous Strat. And I just flipped out. I remember I stood up and started screaming to the embarrassment of my girlfriends at the show. And the next day I went to a pawn shop and I got a Fender Mustang, and I took it with me when I went to New York a few months later to go to journalism school. And I just started, I didn't know anyone in New York City, so I just started going to auditions to try to get in bands. And to my complete shock, I got into a band. I really could barely play, but that's how it started.
Huh. And you grew up in Milwaukee?
I did, yeah.
Ah. So so from the land of Les Paul.
Well, and the blues.
And the blues, yeah.
What was great for me about Milwaukee was I got turned on when I was about 16 to Chicago blues, because I had an older friend who was booking a club called the Metropole and bringing in amazing blues artists from Chicago. And the first show he ever stuck me into was Coco Taylor with Sun Field on guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just knocked flat by Sun Field's guitar playing. I didn't even know what the blues was. I never felt anything so powerful, you know?
And from there, what did it do to you? I mean, because, you know, the folks are going to hear, you know, they're going to hear excerpts from Get Free. And Get Free is not a traditional blues album by any means.
Yeah, I'm a rock artist. I'm not a blues artist. I love the blues, but I never wanted to mimic the blues. And I feel like every artist has a responsibility to try to find her own voice.
Right.
And her own sound. So, you know, I started off playing in hardcore punk bands, industrial bands, then I started working on my own stuff, and I found out that my own voice would definitely doesn't lend itself to Coco Taylor's. Yeah, you know, I sound like more like Sheryl Crow, you know, and I just started falling into this kind of 70s-ish sound for my own music that I would write. But I have a huge love for the blues, and it definitely had a huge influence on my guitar soloing.
Yeah.
And as I explain in my book, The Language of the Blues, it almost has more to do with the aesthetics and the ethics behind the blues. Because when I saw Sun Seals, I really wanted to play guitar, but I was so intimidated by the super fast guitar lead playing I would hear on the radio, like it was Eddie Van Halen or whoever you might hear on, you know, rock radio in the Midwest. And I just was like, well, I'll never be able to play that fast, and I'll never be able to do that. And then I saw Sun, and he would just hit one note, but it would be so the right note that it would just knock you on your flat on your back.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's a different approach to the guitar, and that's kind of cool. And you know, he plays fast.
Yeah, well, so, it's visceral.
It got me excited. Yeah.
So okay, so you played some punk, and you ended up being a really rock player. And yeah, you're definitely a rock player. Like I could so hear you doing a. First off, I could definitely see you opening up for Cheap Trick. That would be amazing.
That would be so fun. I love them.
What a great bill that would be. And I could definitely see you doing a duet with Robin Zander. I mean, I think your voices would really.
That
I think you guys would really complement each other. I really do.
I never would have thought of that, but you know, I love the exhilaration in his voice, and God, that would be so fun. Yeah.
And also, he has and the urgency. He has a lot of urgency in his voice, and I think you have that too. Particularly on there's one track on the first track on the album, When It Comes Down. That's my favorite track on the album. I really love it. I
think that's mine too.
Is it really? No kidding. That's
totally. I just think that's the song. You know, when I was making the Get Free album, I was still trying to sort of figure out, you know, I played guitar for so many different people, and now I was trying to figure out, well, who am I as a solo artist? And, you know, Get Free has a lot of sort of eclecticism on it because I'm sort of trying to feel my way. And I think on When It Comes Down, the sound just all came together. I was like, yeah, that's it. You know, that's what I'm looking for and striving for. That's it.
Yeah, yeah, it's sort of like, to me, it sounds like, oh, this is exactly what she was shooting for the album. Like, this is what the album's really all about, is this track right here.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel about it. Yeah. So, very astute of you, Mark.
Once in a while. Yeah, and it's funny because then I hear the new single, and the new single is part of this cool thing that you're doing. You're releasing. How often are you going to be releasing these singles?
Well, I'm gearing up to try to do roughly one a month.
Okay.
They may be spaced out a bit longer.
Okay.
As I mentioned to you, I just signed a management contract, so my manager and I are working on that. But the hope is to start around November with Butterfly and do a song and a video every 4 to 6 weeks or so.
Okay, cool.
Because I've got the songs are mostly done, working on the videos and mixing and stuff like that now. But yeah, Butterfly will be the first.
Yeah, you know, yeah, and Butterfly to me is like, and I don't know if anyone's even coined this term yet. It's like neo psychedelic.
Oh, cool.
You know,
I don't know
either. I mean, I know there's neo soul out there, and I'm a fan of, like, you know, like Raphael Sadiq and Charles Bradley and people like that. You know, but this is, to me, this is neo psychedelic. So it's like a callback to that vibe, but it's more modern.
Cool. Yeah, it's got a, I mean, I can think of that song, it's got almost a Black Crowes vibe in it too, with the slide guitar and everything. And I think what gives it the psychedelic vibe is we have Mark Ores on keys on that song, who is just fantastic. He played on that Get Free record, and he's toured with the Black Crowes and Blues Traveler, lots of people. And, you know, I asked him to really go nuts on this song. You know, I wanted, like, strings, and actually what I told him was to think about Prince, too, and some of the sort of keyboards that show up on Prince's records that are just really imaginative and kind of wild, you know, and I think he brought more than delivered on that song.
Yeah, I can definitely hear that. But you played the slide guitar on there?
Yeah, I play all the guitars.
So this is the question I always ask, because I love playing slide guitar, and I always ask slide players, do you do an open tuning for this, or is this a standard tuning?
This was in standard tuning.
Okay.
I mostly play standard tuning in slide, because the way I learned to play slide was I just picked it up and started playing it on my guitar. So I do some open tuning, but I use open E. I've got a song I do with slide in open E. And I definitely want to experiment with more of them. And I want to learn some classic blues in their classic open tunings on slide.
Yeah, for sure.
But I'm kind of comfortable in standard tuning on slide.
So let's go back to Milwaukee for a second. So you played Milwaukee around, you played a little bit, but then you came east. Was it right?
I never played in Milwaukee.
Oh, you didn't?
I hadn't. I was still under the parental dictum to not play electric guitar. I was in Milwaukee. It wasn't until I came to New York to go to grad school.
Oh, okay. So you really broke free then.
Yeah, I did. And, you know, my poor parents, both their kids are rock musicians. My brother's a phenomenal drummer with the New York City band Tansy. And, I came here and I got my master's in journalism and I moved downtown to join a punk band.
Is so New York. That is so bohemian.
It's just what happens here. You know, thank God.
Yeah, you're a grad from you've got a degree in journalism from Columbia, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm talking to you, and I'm just like kind of you're an anomaly wrapped in a riddle to me.
Oh, good Lord.
Because it's like
I'm pretty simple, man. I just had the same urge you probably had to play guitar, and it was suppressed for a while for various reasons. And, you know, when it finally came out, I couldn't hold it back anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
But to do all these things that you do, I mean, you're a young person and that has accomplished a lot in a short amount of time. And I can only imagine that you're going to be. I just envision you as a mover and shaker in this industry, such as it is. I mean, it's kind of a
right.
That would be cool. Well, it's a weird. This industry is in a really, really weird state right now, and I mean, I just was talking to Paul Reed Smith not long ago, and we were talking. He said to me, he goes, "Mark, what's wrong with the music industry? What do we do to get kids to play guitar again?" And I said, and I told him, I said, this is not a new problem. This problem has been happening, has been growing and deteriorating since the late 80s, early 90s. As crazy as it sounds and as incestuous as the hair band scene was back in the 80s, and it was very incestuous because everybody looked alike. They sounded alike,
Yeah.
David Lee Roth said it best. What do you get when you have, incest? You get retarded kids. So,
I love
him. But this happened over time, and they realized, wow, we could make a whole lot money, a lot more money, or the same amount of money, if not more, with less overhead by creating a lot of canned music. And I think that, and then of course the inception of the internet, and you know, we love the internet. It's great. It's a great tool and all. But what happened is they weren't prepared for the whole idea of streaming and music sharing and all that. And it really has kind of just brought the monolith down. So I'm wondering, I'm wondering what is going to happen next. I mean, because here you are, you're DIY all the way, pretty much now, with the exception of now signing with a manager. I, you know, someone with a brain like yours needs to figure this out.
I will. I shall. I'll make it my mission.
No pressure. No pressure.
No pressure. No, but you know, Mark, the thing is that like all businesses go through disruption because of technology, right? And this is just, the music business is no exception. Technology came along and disrupted the status quo in a big way. That's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, it's been tough. Don't get me wrong. Like when, okay, so when I was in my punk band, we would put out a record, sell our friends, you know, a few hundred copies of the CD, use that money to rent or buy a van, go on tour. And, you know, we could raise money that way. But, you know, when I had the Get Free album and put it out, it was like, well, nobody's buying CDs. All right, but maybe they'll buy, but they'll buy downloads, right? Nobody's buying downloads. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, great. So how do I, as an artist, raise that little bit of budget to go on tour? And it's really tough, you know? On the flip side, it's giving people like me an opportunity to have careers that have nothing to do with major record labels. And I'm talking to you, even though I'm not signed to Epic or Sony, and I don't particularly want to be. And I think that's pretty exciting. You know, we can kind of create our own, we have to figure out our own business models and figure out what works for us. And people are doing crowdfunding and licensing and sponsorships. And I don't know, I think that's pretty exciting. Because, you know, we can be heard without having to have the rubber stamp of, you know, a major label, which is the only way those hair bands got heard, you know, back in the day. They couldn't do their own thing.
Oh, no.
So, I mean, it's kind of cool. It's crazy. Yeah, I agree. It's crazy and it's difficult. But, you know, this kind of disruption, it just happens. You know, you kind of just got the horses out of the barn, right? And I went through a challenging experience when I did the album, my Get Free album. You know, I was kind of feeling the pain of like, well, now what do I do with it? And this guy, Eric Ibarra from Obama Media, was helping me with my website and with the whole digital marketing thing. And he said, give it away. I was like, what? He's like, give it away. And I was so upset by his suggestion, but after I thought about it for a while, you know, he said, give it away in exchange for email addresses and build real relationships with your fans. And we tried it, and it's been really great. But it was really hard for me to do, you know?
Oh, I bet. I mean, you know, it's that labor of love. You spend so much time on it. And
But since then, I've looked at, you know, it introduced me to a lot of great people. And since then, many of those people have bought my book and have bought CDs and have bought T-shirts. And it's a different business model. And it was hard to do. But we got to be creative.
Well, you're right.
As well as in our art. You know?
You're right. And now, excuse me, and now touring more than ever is the most important part. Getting it in front of people's faces to hopefully excite them enough to say, ooh, I want to own that.
Yeah. You know, and it's funny because my nephew, who, you know, when he was 15, I asked him, I said, do you ever pay for music? And he's like, he just shook his head. He's like, no. Because I was trying to make this decision about, you know, releasing the album that way. But I noticed that, like, when his favorite Norwegian death metal band would come to town, he would shell out, you know, $30 for the ticket and $30 for the T-shirt. And, I mean, that band was making $60 from him, you know.
Plus the ticket, plus the whatever they got at the door.
Yeah, and that's a lot of money for a kid to pull together, but he would work and scrimp and save and do it. So, I'm like, okay, well, this is interesting, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, you know, and that's why more than ever, the people who really enjoy music and participate in the experience of going to see live music and people who listen to this podcast, you know, they mean more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
They totally do. It's like we have two separate music economies. We have one where the big labels are shoving certain artists down your throat
mm-hmm.
and making them hugely, hugely popular, whether they're talented or not.
Mm-hmm.
Some are and some aren't, but, you know, they're just getting that massive PR campaign behind them to make them big stars.
Right.
And then there's a whole other music economy of people like me who really don't care
right.
about that
mm-hmm.
and are just, you know, want to connect with people and make music and have it be viable. And we're, like, able to pull that off more increasingly with all these other options, you know.
Well, that's great to hear. I mean that gives me hope, you know what I mean? So it's really going to be more it's almost like a throwback to the idea of how it was in the early days of rock and roll, in the sense of, okay, it was, you know, or even early like Johnny Cash's career very early on, you know, they'd be part of a caravan of station wagons that were going from, mm-hmm. from gig to gig, playing on the back of a truck, you know,
mm-hmm.
standing on hay bales, literally and figuratively, and doing gigs for, you know, 100 people here, 75 people there, you know, and then it's just a building thing, you know. It is very different, and I just hope that.
Yeah.
I believe everything is full circle. I don't think it's ever going to look mm-hmm. exactly the same as it was. I think the monoliths are gone, but I think
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm an idealist, and I like to think that mm-hmm. you know that it's going to be better. It's going to be great, and that's, you know, kind of what I tried to say to Paul Reed Smith too. But
yeah, I mean, you do have to look at the fact that back in the '60s or '70s, for example, there were some artists who were doing really, really great, but there were many artists who couldn't even record or release anything because they didn't have the top technology that we do today.
Yeah.
You could almost argue that today we're drowning in a lot of terrible music coming out of people's computers.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of like the freedom to make music that mm-hmm. is available to so many more people, just like the freedom to make films is starting to become available to so many more people.
Right. Right. And I don't mean to sound like an old fart or anything, but I'm sorry. You are a DJ is not a musician to me. I'm sorry. If you're at a rave and you're doing a whole bunch of, I'm sorry.
Well, I think it's an art, you know. There are DJs at raves who are artists in what they're doing, you know, cutting up beats, and I mean, I think it's an art form. You know, it may not involve a guitar. Sometimes it does. I've sat in sometimes playing guitar with DJs, and it's been really, really fun.
Right.
But I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I try to keep an open mind.
Well, I was into electronic music when it was just David Byrne and Brian Eno. You know, doing My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. If you want to listen to a great electronic music record, go listen to that. Go listen to the old Walter yeah. Carlos. That's, you know, I don't know. But anyway, that's
yeah.
like, I guess I am being closed-minded.
No, there's a lot of crap out there, you know.
Yeah, I saw one yesterday. It was awful. It was awful. And we were all just staring at each other like, really? But whatever. Anyway, how did you end up becoming associate editor at Blues Review?
Good question. Oh, I know how come. The editor-in-chief at the time was Andrew Roble, who was fantastic. And he actually had written a review about my music for his Ithaca paper. He lives up in Ithaca, New York. And I guess during the course of that, he interviewed us, and I had talked a bit about the blues. And he started asking me to write some stories for Blues Review, and then he hired me as associate editor.
Ah, okay. And was that the was that kind of the gateway to you saying, hey, I think I want to write a book about this?
Yeah, because I was writing about all this stuff, and I was throwing around terms like mojo and hoodoo, And I realized, well, I don't even know what languages these words are, or what do I really know what they mean? Do I know where they're from?
Right.
And I started keeping a list, and I got to about 100 words. And I actually initially was going to co-author the book with Andy. We were both interested in doing it together. Then he just got too busy with his family and the magazine and the other projects he was doing, and gave me his blessing to go forward on my own with it.
Was it a trip for you? I mean, it must have been a real... I mean, just the actual compiling of it, because I've been reading about it. I haven't read the book yet, and I've already asked you off air if you would come back, and we're going to do another conversation about the book in its entirety, because I want to read it first before I really get into it. But how trippy was it for you to, I mean, first of all, you went through all that research and basically detective work as well, finding all that out.
Yeah.
And then later on to get raves from people like Bonnie Raitt and Bonamassa and one of my faves, Jimmy Vivino.
Oh yeah, Jimmy is awesome. Those were very much pinch myself moments, as well as the foreword by Dr. John. You know, the thing is, people who love the blues really love the blues and are very generous about it. And when I first started doing the book, I was overwhelmed by the task I set for myself, and I started doing research, and it was a conversation with Hubert Sumlin, the guitarist Hubert Sumlin, that really gave me my insight on how to make my book a little different. And I had been doing some reading, and I had read that the song Killing Floor, that was written by Helen Wolf, that Wolf had written those lyrics about the Chicago slaughterhouses. That's what he was referring to. So when I got a chance to meet Hubert Sumlin here in New York, I felt very proud of myself to say, oh yes, I'm working on this book. And, you know, for example, I'll be talking about how Killing Floor is about the Chicago slaughterhouses. And Mr. Sumlin pipes up, he says, well, Wolf didn't write that song about that at all. And proceeds to tell me this incredible story about how Wolf wrote that song about feeling depressed and down really low because his girlfriend of his tried to shoot him. And I was floored and humbled and realized that maybe the best contribution I could make as a musician is talk to other musicians about what his words mean and combine that with all the research, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the book is full of interviews and stories from, you know, Robert Jr. Lockwood, Milton Campbell, as many mm-hmm. of these older blues artists that I could find, you know?
Well, I can't wait to read it. I really am looking forward to it. And I definitely want to have you back on to talk about the book, and maybe we'll even do a giveaway with the book as well.
Yeah, I'd love to.
That'll be cool. So I know I'm jumping around a lot, but I can't help it. There's so much to talk about. I want to get back to the singles. Okay, so you got Butterfly, which I really love. I think it's really cool.
Thanks.
It's big. And the more that I think about it, yeah, I do kind of hear what you were saying about the Prince thing, although it doesn't sound anything like Prince at all, but I hear that sensibility. This is going to be 5 singles, and then eventually they're going to be compiled into a EP, and the EP will be called Run Over by the Love Bus, is it?
Yeah, Run Over by the Love Bus.
Okay, is that a hippie euphemism?
It's not. You know, I was looking at the content of all the songs that are about to come out, and they're all in varying degrees have to do with love situations that steer you in crazy directions or just flat out run you over, you know?
I gotcha. That's great. I can't, the title of the actual package has me really curious to hear the rest of the music, so that's cool.
Well, I hope so.
So on the Get Free record, you went ahead and you did a couple of covers on there, and you did some really then kick-ass covers and like great songs, like amazing. You picked good ones.
I never had the boy experience of playing in cover bands in high school and college. When I came out here, I just jumped into this original band, and I've only ever really played original music, so I haven't learned many covers.
Mm-hmm.
But both those covers on the album, one is Neil Young's Needle in the Damage Done, which we do this crazy long jam version of, and the other is Bonnie Raitt's version. It's based on Bonnie Raitt's version of the Del Shannon classic Runaway.
Mm-hmm.
Both those came out because Runaway, I was just messing around with it in rehearsal one day, and my drummer, John Hummel, kicked in with that killer beat, and we just started playing the whole song, and when we were done, the other guys in the band just said, we got to put this on the record. And then Needle in the Damage Done, we were in the recording studio, and I just started playing that as we were warming up, and we were recording, and we went into that crazy long jam that you hear, where we rev it up with rock and take it down into this kind of like dreamy state, and we kept it and worked on it in the studio, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, that's great.
That's how those happened.
Yeah. I dig it. I dig them. They're great covers. And it's not songs that you normally would think of as someone going ahead and saying, oh, let's cover that. And, you know, but I do, it's funny because I totally forgot about Bonnie Raitt's version of it. When I heard it, I didn't think of her at all. I thought of Del Shannon.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I love her version. Her version is the first version of Runaway that I ever heard.
Oh.
And that's how I fell in love with Bonnie Raitt, was I heard her version of Runaway on a jukebox,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, who is this? I love it, you know? So I was really scared to sing it and cover it, but, you know, we just did it,
and
I think we gave it our own little stamp, you know?
Yeah, even though you're a rock artist, you know, what did Muddy say about rock and roll? The blues had a baby, right?
Yeah. We had a baby and they named it Rock and Roll.
Right, exactly. So, you know, being that you are so knowledgeable about the blues, and would you ever consider doing a blues record or a blues-ish record?
Maybe. You know, the thing is, there are so many great blues artists out there. Shanika Copeland, or people who are really carrying on the tradition. Carl Weathersby. Oh my gosh, there's, you know, the Burnside Project down in Mississippi, mm-hmm. Mr. Sip. I mean, these are all artists who are, you know, just born and raised and steeped in the blues. I'm not sure I want to step on your toes, but with that said, I actually am working on a cover of Barry Had a Little Lamb, the Stevie Ray Vaughan version, which is coming out really well, and maybe we'll make it a bonus track on the EP.
Cool.
And I wouldn't mind at some point. I would love to do maybe like a side project or an album that would be blues mm-hmm. covers. That might be great. And I love playing blues guitar, so
yeah,
could be fun.
Well, your slide work is really, I mean, it's real slippery and it's real it's greasy. I love it. It's you got a great slide sound. Let's talk about gear.
Cool.
All right. So you're a Fender person in a big way.
Yeah, I am. I have a Fender Strat, and I'm a Fender Girl Rock Nation artist. I also have a Gibson Les Paul Special that I really love, Mahogany. Mm-hmm. Les Paul Special. I keep that in a weird tuning. I keep that in Dad Gad, but in C sharp.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it's real guttural.
Yeah, it's real low, and I've got humbucker. Well, I put humbuckers in the back position in both of my guitars.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, because I like to have that heavy sound available as well. So
right.
You know, straight up strat sound.
So when you're tuning that low, what gauge string are you using?
I'm using 10s on a Les Paul, believe it or not, because I'm really small. My hands are really small, so that's about the best I can get away with.
Mm-hmm. So
I love to use heavier strings, but you can't bend them as well.
So you've been playing Fender since you got that Mustang in the pawn shop.
Yeah, I have. I love Fender guitars. You know, I love the sound, and I love that biting sound. I love the way the neck feels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just super, super appealing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I've kind of tricked my guitar out.
Well, tell us about that. What do you mean? What did you do?
Well, I put jumbo frets on it for starters.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just looking up something here. I have a 1986 Strat. It's a cherry red finish. Uh-huh. So I put jumbo frets on it, which really seemed to help me with bending. And then I've got two Seymour Duncan vintage rails in the front and the middle, and a humbucker in the bridge, Seymour Duncan. So that kind of figured it out like that.
And what about, what kind of amps are you using now?
I use a lot of different amps. Right now, I'm endorsing Angle uh-huh. amps, which I'm really excited about because they have the versatility. I mean, those are gorgeous sounding amplifiers, and they have the versatility to really, really mimic a huge range of sounds. Because I was really lucky when I did the Geoffrey album to record all the guitars at SST, which is a backline and recording studio in Weehawken, New Jersey. They've got every amp under the sun in there. Mm-hmm. So I used Orange AV30, a Marshall JCM 800, Fender Hot Rod, Fender Blackface, you know. God, what else did I use? Another Boogie Rectifier, a Vox AC30, you know, just... I'm lucky enough when I record there that they just pull out all these different
right,
amps.
Right.
You know?
A nice potpourri.
It's like being in a amp candy store. So great. So I need a lot of amp that can kind of stand, uh-huh. you know, from a vintage Fender Twin Vibe to right. a Mega Boogie, you know, uh-huh. to that kind of crunch. And the Angle amps can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And but yet they don't sound canned. You know, they sound like big tube.
Well, yeah, I have to say, I mean, everything I've heard from you, from the live stuff I've heard, sounds really good. I mean, it's big, which is great.
Yeah, I like big. I like power. I'm like 5 feet tall, so, you know, like, I really love, what I love about playing electric guitar is the feeling of power, and, you know, I feel like it's like a force of nature, like thunder or lightning, you know, uh-huh. it's just this amazingly powerful sound, and I like it to be big, you know?
Yeah, I hear you. What about pedals?
Well, I've used a lot of different pedals, but mainly what I use live is I've just got the Boss Metal Zone and the Boss OS2 uh-huh. and the Boss Digital Delay and a Crybaby Volume Wah. And I find that between those two Boss pedals, I can pretty much get every range of distortion that I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
I can go from, like, really heavy and... You have to be careful with the Metal Zone. If you don't set it right, you get that, like, spooked out, kitty, bad metal sound.
Yeah, all of a sudden it sounds like
hiss. But if you use it right, if you use it right, you can really, like, I really like a cascading gain kind of feeling when I'm soloing.
Uh-huh.
So if you use a low gain on the amp and then gain from the pedals as well, you get that cascading effect that gives you a lot of sustain and a lot of, you know, thickness to the tone, so that's right. what I do live.
Right.
Yeah, in the studio, I tend to not use pedals. I just crank the amps, you know.
And your
but live, they frown on that.
Well, the record sounds great. The production on the record is just phenomenal.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I'm lucky to work with really, really talented engineers, you know.
Great stuff. Great stuff.
Thanks, man.
Well, Deborah, I can't thank you enough for taking some time out to talk with us today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for talking to me. I appreciate it, Mark.
My pleasure. Thanks for being on Guitar Radio Show. Folks, go to DeborahDavy.com. That's D-E-V-I, Davy. Okay, DeborahDavy.com. And check out, you can check out the record there. You can also find it on iTunes and Amazon. You can also find her book, The Language of the Blues. And you can also read some of her blogs and any one of those other publications I was talking about, Huffington Post, Village Voice, RollingStone.com, Guitar World, Vintage Guitar, and even Yoga Journal, which is super cool. You can check her out on Facebook and Twitter as well. Go follow her, find out what's going on. And if you're in the New York area, I highly recommend you go check her out live. Hopefully we can get her down here to Austin and we can get some of that good old rock and roll. Deborah, thank you again for being on the show.
Thank you, Mark.
All right.
Thank you, Mark. Absolutely.
Hold on 1 second. We're going to sign off right here.
Show on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher Radio, GuitarRadioShow.com, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Find Guitar Radio Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And remember, if you like the artists you hear on Guitar Radio Show, don't just stream their music, buy it.
GRS Productions.